Okay, so as we do this meditation, please keep in mind what the purpose is here. And the purpose is to give rise to an easy and natural state of mindfulness. And once you get there, the meditation tends to take off on its own. And to do that, you have to turn the present moment into the pleasant moment. And to do that, just start off as always, by focusing on the body and allowing things to die down all by themselves, having a sense of gentle care for yourself, at the same time being patient to what is happening here. And in this way, mindfulness should gradually arise.
In dieser Meditation gehen wir so vor, dass wir versuchen, auf möglichst natürliche Art und leichte Art die Achtsamkeit entstehen zu lassen. Und um dahin zu kommen, ist es wichtig, den gegenwärtigen Moment in einen angenehmen Moment zu verwandeln. Und zu diesem Zweck gehen wir vor, wie immer, wir richten die Aufmerksamkeit auf den Körper und erlauben den Dingen, von alleine abzuklingen und wir bringen uns selbst gegenüber eine Haltung von Fürsorge und Freundlichkeit auf und gleichzeitig die Geduld, dass die Dinge sich so entwickeln, wie sie sich entwickeln in ihrer eigenen Zeit.
as you practice in this way, remember that a crucial aspect of this practice is an attitude that you bring to the present moment. A positive attitude, a gentle attitude, a caring attitude, it's so essential for you to calm down and become peaceful. The way of doing this is to regard your body and mind as a small child. And a small child, the only way to make it hush and to be quiet is to be gentle and patient with that child. In the same way, be patient and gentle with your body and mind. Think of yourself as your own small child. It is a bit out of control, but with the right attitude, it will calm down.
Und wenn wir so vorgehen, ist es wichtig, dass wir die richtige Haltung zu dem gegenwärtigen Moment einnehmen. Und das ist die eine positive Haltung von Freundlichkeit und Fürsorge. Und um diese Haltung zu entwickeln, ist es gut, sich vorzustellen, dass unser Körper und Geist wie ein kleines Kind sind. Und das beste Mittel, um ein kleines Kind zu beruhigen, ist, dass man freundlich ist und fürsorglich zu ihm ist. Wir stellen uns vor, dass unser eigener Körper und Geist unser eigenes kleines Kind sind, sich mit dieser Haltung in Frieden bringen. Und das Kind ist ein bisschen außer Kontrolle, aber mit der richtigen Freundlichkeit und Sanftheit wird sich beruhigen.
as you practice this kind of gentle patience on yourself, gradually the mindfulness should arise. And it's as if the present moment becomes more clear. And when the present moment achieves a certain degree of clarity, one of the things that you will see, of course, is the breath. And as the breath appears to you in that way, you are already, in a sense, doing anapanasati at that point. So you just stay with the breath. The entire process is entirely effortless. There's no point when you go to the breath. There's no point when you do anything at all. You just allow things to arise in due course.
Und wenn wir so geduldig und selber üben, dann kommt ganz natürlich die Achtsamkeit auf und das zeigt sich, indem der gegenwärtige Moment ein bisschen klarer wird. Und wenn er eine bestimmte Klarheit erreicht, dann tritt ganz automatisch der Atem in unsere Aufmerksamkeit. Und wir beobachten ihn und bleiben dabei, und das ist schon die Anapanasati-Praxis. Und es gibt nicht einen bestimmten Moment, wo wir uns dem Atem zuwenden, sondern das geschieht ganz natürlich in seinem eigenen Rücken. Und wir brauchen nur den ganzen Vorgang zu erlauben, dass er geschehen kann.
So once again, we are coming close to the end of the meditation.
Yeah.
Before we come to the very end, quickly review what has happened over the last half an hour or so, and try to understand the process of meditation. Try to understand those things, those perceptions, and those letting go that lead to peace and quietness of the mind. As you start to understand this process, you start to be able to lead your meditation in a better way.
Hier merken Sie wieder am Ende der Meditation. Und bevor wir ganz zum Schluss kommen, schauen wir nochmal zurück auf das, was in der letzten halben Stunde so passiert ist, auf die Wahrnehmungen und auf das Loslassen, was zu einem friedlichen Zustand geführt hat. Und wir werden ganz allmählich besser verstehen, wie das Ganze funktioniert. Und je mehr wir davon verstehen, umso mehr können wir unsere Meditation auf bessere Art führen.
Okay.
Let us just continue, I suppose, where we left off yesterday. Is this a new question to hear?
There is, okay. At the back. At the bottom, okay. Okay, so one of the questions from yesterday, this is a bit involved, and it's not an easy one. I tried to just give a brief explanation of this. The question is, dear Ajahn, speaking about core teachings, could you please explain the significance and meaning of the reciprocal relationship of name and form and consciousness? Thank you with much metta. So this is all from dependent origination. And if you look at the ordinary sequence of dependent origination, it starts off with avijja that we're talking about today, avijja being the idea of delusion or misunderstanding or even illusion about reality. And then it has, from that illusion comes sankhara. From sankharas you have vijnana, which is consciousness. Sankhara being the doing activity of the mind. Consciousness, and then from consciousness you have name and form. So really you have to understand the whole sequence of these four factors together to be able to understand how name and form and consciousness condition each other, how they relate to each other. One of the famous suttas about dependent origination is the Mahanidana Sutta in the Digha Nikaya, Digha Nikaya 15. And that one is actually slightly different. It ends up at the very end, it says that consciousness conditions name and form, and name and form conditions consciousness. And it stops there. So you have a mutual relationship between the two. Yeah, but for me, it's more interesting to look all the way back to the beginning, to delusion, and to see how this actually works with the idea of avijja at the very beginning of the path. So when I interpret, for me again, the most interesting thing is how this relates to the process of rebirth, because that is where either you continue on into the future, or you stop this entire process. So the way this works in brief is that when you have ignorance or illusion or delusion at the bottom of dependent origination, there's two things that that delusion does. First of all, it gives you a sense of control. Yeah, the idea that I am in charge, I can do things, I can create happiness in the world. The idea of control is a very important part of that delusion. And of course, because you think that you are in control, because you think that you can create your life according to your own ideas, you start acting upon that. And that activity that you do based on that illusion, that is the sankhara aspect. Yes, the sankhara is based on the fact that you misunderstand your ability to influence reality. Another aspect of the delusion is that we think that we understand where happiness is to be found, where problems arise. We understand the difference between dukkha and sukha. And because we think that, and because we think we have agency, we can do something about that, we start acting upon that. And all that activity is what sankhara is about. Volitional activity, trying to create happiness for ourselves, trying to avoid suffering for ourselves. When we do all of these volitional activities, that affects our consciousness in the sense that if we do good things, to achieve our happiness, it will have a positive effect on our consciousness. We'll kind of lift it up. You feel better about yourself, It will lift the consciousness up to a, if you like, a higher kind of plane, more light, more easy, more happy consciousness. Whereas if you do bad things, because you feel responsible for these activities, that is part of the delusion of self. If you do bad things, you feel bad about yourself. And you're dragging yourself down, loading up the consciousness with negative qualities, and you feel bad as a consequence. So all the volitional activities we do have a direct effect on our consciousness, either lifting it up or dragging it down. And the total sum of these things will then decide where consciousness is heading in the future. The more you have of the good acts, the less you have the bad ones. The lighter the consciousness becomes, the more imbued it is with happiness and good qualities. The more you do of the bad things, the less you do of the good stuff, the more you're dragging yourself down, getting heavy consciousness, which is imbued with suffering and problems, all these kind of things. So the level of the consciousness changes as you act through your life. If you lead your life really well and you move towards, gradually kind of lifting yourself up, it means that your level of consciousness is going to be at a higher state when you die than when you started off, when you were born into this world. And this is a very important part of this path, right? Of lifting ourselves up, allowing the consciousness to soar by cutting off all the heavy actions and filling up the balloon with helium. Helium is like a good action, so you soar up and you become a lighter person as a consequence. And that level of consciousness, wherever you are when you pass away, that is where you continue into your future life. Because the level you create in this life is where you continue when you pass away. And that place where you continue, if you like, that plane or that level or whatever you want to call it, the nama rupa will then be decided according to the level of consciousness. So if you have lived a very good life, your consciousness is light and beautiful, and you get reborn in a devaloka, you will experience nama rupa, which is equivalent to the devaloka, depending on what kind of devaloka you get reborn into. So nama rupa is basically the qualities of the mind, the qualities of your experience. That is what nama rupa is. And that quality of experience will then depend on the quality that consciousness has when you pass away. So that is in one way this relationship, and this is how you can see through the rebirth process the connection between the first four links of dependent origination. But of course the idea here is to stop this whole rebirth process, and the way to stop that then, just very briefly, when delusion is seen through, right, you actually understand that the limits are, you see through the idea of non-self, you understand that, you see that suffering and happiness actually is very different from what you thought they were, then you stop all those volitional activities. You don't act upon that anymore because you understand that activity that you were doing before was pointless. It wasn't getting you to where you wanted. In fact, it is by stopping those very activities that you actually move towards where you want to go. And because you do that, you are no longer, your consciousness is no longer imbued with those qualities. You are no longer responsible for your activities because you don't do those activities anymore. So consciousness becomes a, if you like, a neutral consciousness that is not actually heading towards any particular state in the future. And because the consciousness isn't heading towards any particular state, because it doesn't really have that level, because you have stopped acting upon delusion that you did before, it means that the consciousness is not heading towards a particular level. There's no namarupa on the other end that is equivalent to the level of consciousness. And because the consciousness is not attaching to or moving towards or craving for any namarupa, it means it is not established there. And the consciousness which isn't established is a consciousness that ceases because it needs that establishment in namarupa to continue into a future existence. It's quite technical, but that is a rough idea of how the four first factors on the noble age of the dependent origination, how they work together in a sense.
Okay. Wenn wir über die Kernlehren sprechen, so geht die Frage, kann bitte erklärt werden, also die Bedeutung oder die Bedeutung der wechselseitigen Beziehung zwischen Name und Form und Bewusstsein. Name und Form oder Namarupa und Bewusstsein sind zwei Faktoren aus der Kette des Abhängigen entstehen. Und es gibt ein Sutta im Digha Nikaya, das Mahanidana Sutta, was bei diesen beiden Punkten quasi endet, dass die Ursache für Namarupa das Bewusstsein ist und die Ursache für das Bewusstsein ist Namarupa. Und es geht nicht zurück zu den beiden vorherigen Gliedern des Abhängigen Entstehens, die in anderen Lehrreden noch genannt werden. Das erste Glied ist in der üblichen Reihenfolge die Unwissenheit, Avijja, Unwissenheit oder Illusion oder Täuschung. Und aus der Täuschung heraus haben wir falsche Vorstellungen und aus diesen falschen Vorstellungen heraus handeln wir auf eine bestimmte Art. Das ist das Glied Sankara, das zweite Glied in der Kette. Und aus dieser Aktivität heraus, oder durch diese Aktivitäten, diese Aktivitäten haben mir fallen mir keine deutschen Wörter ein, nur Englisch. Die Aktivitäten, die wir aufgrund dieser Täuschung vollziehen, haben eine karmische Wirkung und haben einen Einfluss auf unser Bewusstsein. Und unser Bewusstsein wird dadurch in eine bestimmte Ebene hingezogen. Also wenn wir jetzt zum Beispiel gute Dinge tun, wird das Bewusstsein angehoben und wird leichter und findet sich in höheren Ebenen wieder. Und wenn wir schlechte Dinge tun, wird das Bewusstsein nach unten gezogen, es wird schwer, es wird geht in tiefere, niedrigere Ebenen hinein. Und wenn das Leben endet und die Summe aus den guten und schlechten Taten bestimmt eine Ebene, wo sich das Bewusstsein ungefähr da einpendelt oder wo es sich etabliert. Und wenn wir dann am Ende des Lebens sterben, der Körper fällt weg, und dann ist das Bewusstsein in dieser Ebene und das ist die Ebene, die auch unsere Wiedergeburt bestimmt und wo sich ein neues Namarupa dann mit dem Bewusstsein etabliert. Und das ist diese Abhängigkeit zwischen Namarupa und dem Bewusstsein. Das sind im Prinzip diese vier ersten Faktoren der Kette, die hier zusammenwirken. Der wichtige Punkt ist dann nachher, wie kann man diese ganze Kette enden? Wie kann das Ganze zum Anhalten gebracht werden? Wenn es gelingt, die Täuschung aufzulösen, die am Anfang der Kette steht, dann gibt es eigentlich keinen Grund, diese ganzen Aktivitäten zu vollführen, weil die Aktivitäten, die Sankaras, auf der falschen Annahme beruhen, dass wir einen Einfluss und eine Kontrolle hätten über die Gestaltung des Lebens. Tatsächlich ist es aber, wenn wir die Täuschung durchschauen, so, dass wir sehen, das führt zu gar nichts. Und das Aufhören mit diesen Aktivitäten ist eigentlich das, was uns dahin führt, wo wir am liebsten hinwollen. Und wenn wir mit den Aktivitäten aufhören, gibt es auch nichts mehr, keine Richtung, keine Ebene, zu der unser Bewusstsein sich hingezogen fühlt. Und es wird auch in keinem Namarupa mehr irgendwie etabliert. Und es wird, dieser ganze Prozess der Wiedergeburt wird damit zum Ende kommen. Ich hoffe, ich habe das ungefähr so ein bisschen vielleicht kurz zusammengefasst. Man hat nichts Wichtiges vergessen.
Okay, good, yeah. Okay. So, the next question here is, the Mahapanibbana Sutta seems to indicate that the Buddha knew Chunda's meal would kill him. Why do you think he still ate it? Was this intentional killing in a way? Thank you. That is an interesting question, and it is it's very strange when you read the Mahapanibbana Sutta. It seems like the Buddha eats this meal even though he knows that it isn't any good, that he's going to get food poisoning and dysentery and all these problems from the meal. So it almost looks like he's kind of committing suicide. Yeah, that's what it looks like there. It's kind of strange to think of the Buddha might be committing suicide. Not really suicide, more like perhaps euthanasia. He's getting old and he's probably kind of decided it's the end of his life anyway. So it's kind of a balance between assisted ending of life or suicide. But it almost looks like the Buddha is taking his own life in a way there at the very end. Is that possible? Is that conceivable? It's strange. When you read the sutta as a new way, kind of new ideas come up like that. Is it possible that the Buddha may have ended his own life? It's very hard to say. Maybe it is possible. It does sound a bit strange, rather the kind of thing that you expect to see. But maybe it is conceivable that the Buddha actually had to make a particular decision. Okay, now I've come to the end of my life. Now is the time to make an end of this, and this is the way I'm going to do it. But I think an alternative hypothesis, an alternative way of reading this, is to remember that now we are dealing with a story, and the storyline may not have been retold exactly the way things happened. There's a lot of uncertainty in the narrative aspect, the story aspect in the suttas. And because of that, I don't think we should put too much weight on these little details. Did the Buddha really know that he was eating this? It is really uncertain whether he even had a last meal that was poisonous in the first place. Even that is uncertain, because it only exists in the Pali, it does not exist in the Sanskrit version of the sutta. The Chinese version, not sure of, but certainly not in the Sanskrit version. So the whole storyline is a bit uncertain. So I wouldn't place too much emphasis on that sort of thing. And I would say the most likely explanation is just that he had a meal that was bad, and then he died from having a bad meal. That would be my reading of that. I don't see the question.
Die Frage betrifft die Stelle im Mahapanibbana Sutta, wo der Buddha seine letzte Mahlzeit isst. Und die Frage geht darum, hat der Buddha wissentlich ein Mahl gegessen, von dem er wusste, es würde ihn umbringen? Und hat er damit sich selber auf eine Art das Leben genommen? Und es ist tatsächlich eine interessante Frage. Klingt so, wenn man das Mahapanibbana Sutta liest, als hätte der Buddha auf eine Art Selbstmord begangen, indem er dieses Mahl gegessen hat, von dem er wusste, es ist unverträglich, er wird eine Lebensmittelvergiftung, einen schlimmen Durchfall bekommen und wird daran sterben und hat es trotzdem gegessen. Und meine Antwort darauf ist eher so, dass ich denke, man muss diese Einzelheiten vielleicht auch als eine Geschichte sehen, die erzählt worden ist, und ob es sich tatsächlich genauso abgespielt hat, das ist zu einem gewissen Grad auch unsicher. Und die Stelle kommt nicht in allen Versionen des Mahaparinibbana Sutta vor. Bei der chinesischen Version bin ich mir nicht sicher, aber in Sanskrit bin ich mir sicher, dass es nicht vorkommt. In der Pali-Version wird es eben so erzählt. Aber meine ganze, mein Verständnis von der Sache ist, der Buddha hat einmal gegessen, das er nicht vertragen hat, und er ist daran gestorben. Und mehr kann man dazu mit Sicherheit nicht sagen.
Okay, good. So the next question, really easy one, I can answer in one word. Have you got any upcoming plans to lead a pilgrimage to the sacred sites of India? And the answer is no, very, very quick one.
Und die nächste Frage ist sehr schnell zu beantworten. Haben Sie irgendwelche konkreten Pläne, eine Pilgerreise nach Indien zu führen? Und die Antwort heißt nein.
Yeah, it's actually very nice to go to India at least once in a lifetime, because it's really inspiring to see the places where the Buddha was. Sometimes you get the feeling for the presence of the Buddha and all these kind of things. But I've already been to India many times, and the truth is that after a while you get a bit, at least personally, I have a feeling of having enough of traveling to India. Even the Buddhist holy sites are so busy, there's so much noise, there's so many things happening. There's so much pollution over there. There's so many problems that when you've done it a few times, you kind of feel that, okay, sufficient. Now I kind of get on with my practice instead. Yeah.
Es ist sicher eine gute Sache, wenn man einmal diese Pilgerorte in Indien gesehen hat. Und es ist sicher sehr inspirierend und sehr anregend, das zu sehen. Ich bin jetzt schon mittlerweile ein paar Mal dort gewesen und ich habe das Gefühl, für mich reicht das. Und selbst diese heiligen Stätten sind so überlaufen und so laut und so unruhig und es gibt so viele Probleme dort. Und ich habe das Gefühl, ich habe sie oft genug gesehen und es ist für mich wichtiger, mit meiner eigenen Praxis fortzufahren.
Yeah, Adam Brown, he always says that instead of visiting the four holy sites outside, visit the four holy sites inside. And they are the first jhana, second jhana, third jhana and fourth jhana.
Adam Brahm sagt, statt die vier heiligen Stätten im Außen zu besuchen, soll man lieber die vier heiligen Stätten innen besuchen. Und das ist das erste Jhana, das zweite Jhana, das dritte Jhana und das vierte Jhana.
Okay, so next one. Can you go further to expand beyond, are you saying to go further beyond, to expand beyond the five precepts? Please give some points. Thank you. Okay, so the idea about, you know, the five precepts, they are fairly limited, and we're going to have a look at this maybe tomorrow or the day after or whenever, when we're going to start to look at the gradual training. But what you see there is that the idea, the morality is expanded far more in the gradual training than it is with the five precepts. So, first of all, the five precepts only have about not lying. Yeah, not lying is the musavada. But when we look at the expanded training on right speech, it is much more than that. It is about not speaking divisively, not speaking harshly, and all of these kind of things. So this is the first thing, is about speech. And of course, if you look at the precepts in their own right, all they say is not to do these bad things. They don't actually say anything about doing the good things. So this is the other side of the coin, is always to actually practice, not just avoiding the bad actions, but doing the good actions. Yeah, so being actively compassionate, being actively generous, actively saying kind and gentle things to other people. Yeah, so the opposite side of what the precepts actually say here. And the third aspect, which is very important on the Buddhist path of sila, is the mental aspect of things. We actually have to cultivate the mind, learn to think about things in a different way. And it's quite astonishing once you start to learn to perceive the world and look at the world in a different way. Your entire attitude to people can change. You can reduce your ill will, reduce all the negative aspects of the mind, and build up the patience, the compassion, the friendliness, and all of these kind of things. And I'm going to talk about this quite a lot later on, because I think these are really important issues. Because once you get a handle on these things, that is where meditation really starts to take off.
Und die Frage betrifft, ob Adam noch mehr über die fünf wieder erklären kann. Und er sagt, das wird im weiteren Verlauf, wenn wir das stufenweise Training besprechen, noch vorkommen. Die fünf Sieger haben ihre Grenzen, zum Beispiel wenn man die rechte Rede betrachtet, in den Sigas heißt es einfach nur nicht zu lügen, aber die Erläuterungen über die rechte Rede, die in stufenweisen Training gegeben werden, die gehen viel weiter. Es geht auch noch darum, dass man mit seiner Rede nicht andere gegeneinander aufbringt, dass man keine harten Worte benutzt und so weiter. Und
Doing the good side, yeah. Thanks, another one. Okay. Yeah.
Das nächste, was noch wichtig ist, dass man auch im eigentlichen Text der fünf Ethikregeln, da wird nur praktisch beschrieben, was man nicht tun soll, aber die andere Seite, die Kehrseite der Medaille, das, was man stattdessen tun soll, die guten Sachen, werden dort nicht beschrieben, aber die sind auch ganz wichtig, um den Pfad zu entwickeln, dass man die guten Qualitäten wie Freundlichkeit und Güte und Frieden und Mitgefühl und so weiter entwickelt. Naja, und das dritte ist, dass der geistige Aspekt der Sieger ganz, ganz wichtig ist, dass es darum geht, den Geist zu entfalten, in eine bestimmte Richtung zu entwickeln und nicht nur das körperliche und sprachliche Handeln.
Okay, so next one. Could you please elaborate on yesterday's advice? Install sati first, then, not too early, take up the meditation object. Thank you. Yes, I can elaborate on that. So the idea here is to, this is one of the things that you see throughout the suttas, is that you have to have a certain degree of mindfulness. Actually, mindfulness comes in many different degrees, right? Many different varieties, many different strengths. But you have to have a basic mindfulness established for meditation to be possible. I think I mentioned yesterday, you see that in the Satipatthana Sutta, you see it in the Anapanasati Sutta, and you see it also elsewhere. Without that basic mindfulness, meditation really is impossible, because your mind is too distracted, right? Your mind kind of goes this way, it goes that way, and it doesn't have the stability to be able to maintain the observation of the object that is there. So the basic idea of sati is just that you are pretty much in the present moment. You have a certain clarity about the present moment. You know what is going on. There's maybe a little bit of thinking going on, but not very much. And that is kind of the idea of sati here. And already getting to that point is actually quite difficult for many people. Many people are, we are very active in our lives. We are doers. We like to think about things, to reflect about things. And actually just being completely still and quiet actually is not that easy. It's not that it's difficult. It's just that it takes a bit of training and a bit of wise attention to get there. And once you get there, you start to see the benefits of what is going on. So the idea, instead of going to the breath straight away, and this is one of the classic things that sometimes people do, they straight away go to the breath when they sit down. Actually, if you're going to follow the advice of the Buddha, I don't think that is the right way to do it. First of all, establish mindfulness. Then, when mindfulness is established, then you watch the breath. If you go to the breath too quickly, the only way you're going to be able to keep on watching it is by grasping it. It's the only way. And when you grasp the breath and you use willpower and force to hold on to it, it means you can't really relax properly. Yeah, it is not really all that enjoyable. But when you have a kind of a sense of mindfulness, when you have a distance between yourself and the object, no sense of grasping, but just being the passenger on the train, all you're doing is allowing that object to be, and just observing it for whatever it is. No control, no holding, no willpower, nothing like that. It's so easy, and it's so natural, and it feels so good. There's a sense of pleasure there, just watching the breath and being with the breath. And that is what we're trying to do. So a lot of the preparatory work is just to allow mindfulness to arise. And you allow it to arise in as natural a way as possible. Again, not using willpower. Very often people say, I'm going to be mindful. And they're really kind of, and they kind of use willpower that way. And it doesn't really work, right? After a while you get tired. The mind gets worn out. So we try to use the mind in such a way that the mindfulness arises naturally here. And to do that, this is what this is all about. You have to first of all be comfortable, you have to be relaxed, you have to be at ease, you have to have the right attitude, a sense of positive experience of what is going on. Yeah, when all that kind of comes together, then because you're feeling good in the present moment, mindfulness tends to come as a result. And if it doesn't come, it is not really so surprising, because it's even that is very unusual for people, just to be quiet in the present moment, not having any thoughts about it. So don't feel disappointed if it doesn't happen, because it is not so, it is not obvious that these things should happen, but that is kind of the idea. Yeah, and then the meditation becomes pleasurable, no willpower, you're just enjoying the whole process. And this is kind of the point here. One of the important things about the Buddhist path, it is something that you have to sustain for years, for decades, perhaps sometimes for lifetimes, right? If you don't get it out of the way in this life, you may have to kind of continue in your next life. The only way you're going to be able to persevere for lifetimes is if you're enjoying what you're doing. If it is a pain, if it is kind of all terrible, after a while you're going to give up and you're going to find another religion. Yeah, and what a terrible thing that is if you find another religion. What a waste of an opportunity. Maybe you think that, or maybe you just become an atheist, or you kind of, yeah, when I die, it's all going to be over anyway. So it's kind of, and then of course you have wasted a chance to practice these beautiful teachings. And that is what we're trying to avoid. One of the things we're trying to avoid here.
Okay. Die Frage ist, oder eine Bitte, über den Rat von gestern ist mehr zu sagen, zuerst Sati zu etablieren und dann erst danach und nicht zu früh zum Meditationsobjekt zu gehen. Und das wird sowohl im Anapanasati-Sutta so gesagt, als auch im Satipatthana-Sutta oder an anderen Stellen. Und es ist auch leicht nachvollziehbar, dass die Achtsamkeit erstmal da sein muss. Ansonsten, wenn man zum Beispiel Leute, die sich hinsetzen und sofort mit der Aufmerksamkeit auf den Atem draufspringen und die einzige Chance, die sie überhaupt haben, dann den Atem zu beobachten, ist, wenn sie den Atem irgendwie festhalten und mit Willenskraft versuchen, beim Atem zu bleiben. Aber das führt natürlich dazu, dass man sich nicht entspannen kann, dass man innerlich angespannt ist und dass man quasi davon müde wird und dass man den Spaß an der Meditation vielleicht auch verliert. Wichtig ist, dass man diese Achtsamkeit zuerst auf möglichst natürliche Art und Weise aufbaut, indem man sich entspannt, indem man eine bequeme Sitzposition findet, indem man die innere Haltung zu sich selber auch so entspannt wie möglich sein lässt, indem man sich nicht versucht, zu irgendetwas zu zwingen, indem man dem ganzen Prozess erlaubt, sich von selber zu entfalten und auch nicht enttäuscht ist, wenn das nicht oft auf Anhieb klappt, denn es ist auch normal, dass es vielleicht seine Zeit braucht und dann einfach das genießt, so wie es sich eben entwickelt. Und wenn man sich vorstellt, dass die Übung der Meditation Jahre oder Jahrzehnte oder vielleicht auch mehrere Leben benötigt, bis man zum Ziel kommt, dann gibt es eigentlich nur eine Chance, dass man so lange durchhält, nämlich dass man das Ganze auf irgendeine Art einfach auch genießen kann. Sonst wird man irgendwann das Ganze hinschmeißen oder wird sich eine andere Religion suchen oder wird dann zum Atheisten oder ja, dann hat man am Ende des Lebens hat man eine Chance vertan.
Okay, so next one. So as follows, I found accepting one's own decay and displeasure in life easier than seeing this in other people. Certainly when there is suffering like pain and cancer, etc. I find I have difficulty in separating the person, the self, and the illness. Okay, so it's easier to accept it in yourself than it is in others. Well, that's it's good that you can accept it in yourself at least. That's really, really important, right? You can deal with that. It's very, it's already very useful. And It is also very useful, of course, to be able to accept it in others, especially if they are close family members and this sort of thing. And I have, in my own family, I have both my father and my sister actually have quite serious cancer. And the way I think about this, you know, having been a monk for 20 years, the way I deal with it is basically to look at their lives. And both my father and my sister, they've had quite good lives. And secondly, they have lived quite well. So when I think of that, I think, well, actually, if you have lived quite well and you have good lives at the same time, how can you really complain? The length of life is something you can never really control. You can never really know where things are going to go in terms of length of life. But what you can control, what you have some destiny over, something you can actually deal with to some extent, is the how you live your life. And if somebody has lived their life well, hooray, well done, right? You're going to die now, no big deal. It is not about the length of life that matters, but the quality of life that matters. You've had a good quality. Far better to have a short life with good quality. Actually, it's not that short anyway. It's kind of fairly long already. So much better to have a medium-long life or a not-too-long life, which is well-lived, than having a long life that is badly lived. Yeah, so that's the way I think about these things. And when I think like that, I think, okay, if they're gonna die. That's what you have to expect anyway. It's gonna happen sooner or later. If it happens sooner than you expected, well, that's just a good lesson in the uncertainties of these things. So that is really the way of dividing the person from the illness, to see the qualities in that person. Yeah, and to understand that those qualities are worth celebrating if they are good. And if the qualities are bad, well, then you have to have compassion regardless of whether they have an illness or not.
Okay. Ich fand es einfacher, ich finde es einfacher, die Tatsache der Vergänglichkeit und der Unannehmlichkeiten im Leben für mich selber zu sehen, als es in anderen Leuten zu sehen oder zu akzeptieren. Bei mir selber ist einfacher, fällt mir leichter, als das bei anderen Leuten zu akzeptieren. Zum Beispiel bei Krankheiten wie Krebs und so weiter. Und ich finde es schwierig, zwischen der Person und der Krankheit zu trennen. Und die Antwort lautet, es ist schon mal sehr gut, dass so etwas bei dir selber akzeptieren zu können. Das ist ein wichtiger Schritt, der sehr, sehr gut ist. Aber es ist auch hilfreich, wenn man es bei anderen akzeptieren kann, vor allem wenn es enge Angehörige sind. Zum Beispiel bei mir ist es so, dass mein Vater und auch meine Schwester an Krebs erkrankt sind, ernsthaft erkrankt sind. Und die Art und Weise, wie ich damit umgehe, ist, dass ich mir anschaue, wie die Lebensqualität ist und dass ich mir sage, sie haben beide ein gutes Leben gehabt und haben ihr Leben auch auf gute Weise gelebt. Und die Länge des Lebens ist eigentlich nicht das Wichtigere, sondern die Qualität ist viel, viel wichtiger und viel ausschlaggebender als die Länge des Lebens. Über die Länge haben wir überhaupt keine Kontrolle, wie lange wir leben, aber über die Qualität haben wir doch zu einem gewissen Maß eine Kontrolle und wir können unser Leben auf gute Art und Weise leben. Und die Unterscheidung zwischen der Person und der Krankheit, das kommt auch an diesem Punkt dann ins Spiel, dass man vielleicht besser eben nach den Qualitäten schaut. Und wenn es gute Qualitäten sind, ist es ein Grund, sich mit der Person darüber zu freuen. Und wenn die Qualitäten schlecht sind, dann ist es eben ein Anlass, um Mitgefühl zu entwickeln, egal ob die Person jetzt krank ist oder bald sterben wird oder nicht.
Okay, so I hope I understood your question properly. If not, then please try again later on or try to answer it later on.
Ich hoffe, dass ich die Frage richtig verstanden habe. Und wenn nicht, dann bitte nochmal fragen oder zu einem späteren Zeitpunkt nochmal einen Zettel in den Kasten tun.
Okay, so this other question here is, can we do a guided metta meditation, please? Thank you. And we can. We'll do that maybe tomorrow, the day after, something like that. I'll just put it to one side here, so I don't forget about it.
Die nächste Frage ist eine Bitte um eine geführte Metta-Meditation. Was können wir morgen oder übermorgen tun?
Okay, then we have a next question here is, could you please speak on the conditions which enable us to keep sila? Thank you. And this is another, I think, very good question. The kind of question I like is very practical, very down to earth. And it's also the understanding that being virtuous and doing the right thing is often not that easy. You forget, you lose your mindfulness, you don't know what's going on. So how can we ensure that we kind of maximize the potential of living in the right way all the time? It's actually a very important question. I think it's a very useful one. And it's a question that comes up in the sutta that I'm going to read, continue. I just started off this afternoon. I'm going to continue tomorrow morning. The Avijja Sutta. It actually comes all in there. But I can give you a bit of a preview, a bit of a kind of tell you what's going to happen there, basically, in, down the track. So, the thing that kind of enables you to be have sila, of course, is basically mindfulness, right? You have to have a degree of mindfulness to be sure that you are to be aware of what's going on, so you can actually correct your actions, correct the way you think according to what is going on in your mind. So mindfulness is an absolute kind of bare minimum requirement. So that is the first thing. The second thing that is required for you to be able to live, have sila properly, is what is called in the sutta a clear comprehension or full awareness. So you have to have the awareness of what you're doing is appropriate or not. Whether it's going to lead in the right direction or not. And sometimes that actually is more complicated than it may seem. It may seem obvious that certain acts are in the wrong way, other acts are in the right way. But actually, it is not always so as obvious as it may seem, especially when it comes to the more subtle aspects of morality. So having that clear, full awareness is another aspect that enables you to live, to have sila. And then there is the third aspect, and that is also coming in the sutta we're going to have a look at tomorrow, and that is yoniso manasikara, which is often translated as wise attention or careful attention on what is happening here. And yoniso manasikara is the ability, is having enough wisdom to move your mind away from a bad way of thinking and moving it on to a wholesome way of thinking. And this can often be difficult. If you are about to get angry with somebody, how do you change your perception so that the anger is subdued and you have a sense of compassion perhaps even a sense of friendliness, but at the very least you have a neutral feeling towards that person. So how do you change your perception to enable you to move away from the anger towards a more wholesome state? That is what yoniso manasikara does. So these are the kind of the three of the things that are very important to enable you to live, to have sila. And of course the point here is to have sila in your life as consistently as possible. But it's even more complicated, right? Because then the next question then is, well, how do you have that mindfulness? How can you ensure that you have mindfulness all the time? I think that actually is a question that comes up afterwards. Well, something like that anyway. So how can mindfulness be established? Ultimately there isn't, we can always go back one step further, but the way to establish mindfulness and to always remind you what you need to do and to kind of live in the right way, ultimately it comes back to the word of the Buddha or the word of the Aryans or the word of the Saparisa, as it says in the sutta. The Saparisas are like the superior people, the Aryans, those who have understood the Dhamma. So it comes back to that. So it comes back to, you always have to inspire yourself, to remind yourself what these teachings are. So every week or every few days or whenever you feel you need a bit of inspiration or whatever, you have to go back to the suttas or go back to somebody who presents the suttas in a good way to allow yourself to be inspired and reminded of what these teachings are. And this is really the root cause of everything else on the Buddha's path. So if you want to find the root cause of root causes, that is really the one. So go back to the suttas, these four volumes over here, and listen to nice talks, listen to inspiring teachers who hopefully know what they're talking about. And as you do that, you will kind of ensure that you're always growing in those good qualities. That is what it really comes back to.
Okay, die Frage betrifft die Voraussetzungen, die nötig sind, um die Sila einzuhalten. Und das Erste, was man braucht, ist ein Mindestmaß an Achtsamkeit, dass man sozusagen mitbekommt, was man tut. Dass man dass man eben wahrnimmt, was gerade abgeht und was man tut. Das ist ganz wichtig, um die richtige Entscheidung zu treffen und richtig zu handeln, dass man ein Minimum an Achtsamkeit hat als erste Voraussetzung. Die zweite Voraussetzung ist das, was oft mit einem klaren Verständnis oder mit klares Verständnis übersetzt wird, dass man versteht die Zusammenhänge, die sich jetzt gerade abspielen, in dem Moment, in dem es passiert. Dass man oft ist es so, dass es recht eindeutig ist, ob eine Handlung gut oder schlecht ist oder angemessen oder unangemessen, aber gerade in den subtileren Bereichen ist es manchmal nicht ganz so klar. Und da ist diese innere Klarheit eben ganz wichtig, dass die entwickelt wird. Und das Dritte, was notwendig ist, ist das, was mit Yoniso, also was in Pali Yoniso Manasikara heißt und was meistens mit Weise, Aufmerksamkeit übersetzt wird. Und das ist im Grunde genommen die Fähigkeit, einen unheilsamen Zustand oder eine unheilsame Denkrichtung umzuwandeln in eine heilsame. Wenn man zum Beispiel Ärger empfindet, dass man die Fähigkeit entwickelt, zu sagen, was ist jetzt das Heilsame, anstatt des Ärgers, dass man es einem gelingt, den Ärger in zum Beispiel Mitgefühl oder Güte zu verwandeln oder zumindest in eine neutrale Haltung gegenüber dieser Person, über die man sich gerade jetzt ärgert. Dann kann man natürlich nochmal die nächste Frage stellen, welche Voraussetzungen brauchen diese Qualitäten, zum Beispiel die Achtsamkeit, damit sie entwickelt werden. Und da geht es Schritt um Schritt immer nochmal etwas zum nächsten Faktor zurück. Und am Ende läuft es darauf hinaus auf das Wort des Buddha. Das steht am Anfang von allen heilsamen Aktivitäten und jeder heilsamen Entwicklung, dass man das Wort des Buddha hört oder liest oder Vorträge von Ethen, von den höheren Menschen, wie das in Pali ausgedrückt wird, die Menschen, die den Dhamma gesehen und verstanden haben und die ihn erklären können, dass man darauf nochmal Rückgriff nimmt und immer, wenn man das Gefühl hat, man braucht nochmal ein bisschen Inspiration, ein bisschen Erinnerung an die guten Qualitäten, dass man dann eben zu den Suttas geht und sie liest oder sich entsprechende Vorträge anhört, die einem nochmal ein bisschen Begeisterung und Inspiration bringen.
Okay, so this next one is a little bit similar in some ways, and would you kindly repeat the correct translation of the Buddha's words to the monks before he passed away concerning appamada? So I like your faith in me that I have a correct translation. That's really, really kind of you to think that. Remember that there often isn't any one correct translation, right? There are different translations, and every translation gives you a slightly different angle on a certain problem. But the Pali word is appamadena sampadeta, and basically it means something, gain success through heedfulness. Achieve success through heedfulness. That is a fairly literal way of rendering that. And does appamada mean sati? Does it mean mindfulness? And upheedfulness is similar to mindfulness, but it is more than that. You have to be mindful to be heedful. Heedful in the English language means something like being careful. It means considering carefully what you're doing, whether it is right or wrong. It can be called circumspection, perhaps. You're circumspect about what you're doing. All of these words. So it requires sati, it requires mindfulness, because if you have no mindfulness, you can't really think about what you're doing, whether it's right or wrong. But it's more than mindfulness. There's also a degree of wisdom there, and that is what we're just talking about, the idea of yoniso manasikara, of understanding what you're doing, whether it is appropriate, and how to get away from that if you're heading in the wrong way. So all of those come in there. You can start with that, Saramita, if you like.
Yeah. already too long.
It's already too long. Okay.
Die Frage geht darum, die Übersetzung für die letzten Worte des Buddha, dass sie nochmal wiederholt werden kann, oder die korrekte Übersetzung des Pali-Wortes Appamada, bedeutet das Appamada Achtsamkeit oder Sati, das sind drei Fragen am Stück, und wie kann die Achtsamkeit entwickelt werden?
I haven't replied that one yet, so
it's
still waiting, yeah.
Okay, okay. Okay, der Pali-Ausdruck heißt Appamadena Sampadena und die Übersetzung heißt, ihr sollt Erfolg haben durch Sorgfalt und Umsicht. Wenn ich das englische Wort heedfulness mal so übersetze. Und es ist also nicht das Gleiche wie die Achtsamkeit, aber Achtsamkeit ist die Voraussetzung, damit man diese Sorgfalt und Umsicht entwickeln kann.
I'll probably get enough. I'm sure that's fine. Yeah, I'll just do the last one, and then you can translate that one. So the last one is, how can mindfulness be established from moment to moment, working against forgetting about mindfulness? So mindfulness is precisely remembering, right? So this is kind of the problem. To be mindful, you have to be mindful of the fact that you're not mindful, which is impossible if you haven't got mindfulness. So it makes things very complicated. So again, it comes back to this basic idea of you have to make mindfulness important, right? You have to give it priority. It has to be something that you really feel is important in your life. And this was one of the things that I was trying to say also in meditation practice, when you sit down, to get this idea that this really matters. This is what life is really about. Everything else is secondary. In fact, everything else is used to enable you to be mindful and to meditate in the present moment. And if you get to that point of view, where you feel this is the most important thing in the whole world, and you really feel that, of course, it is far easier to be mindful as a consequence. So this is a kind of tricks of perception that you have to use to enable mindfulness to arise. In the long run, the most important thing that will allow mindfulness to be there is again sila, is the ability to develop sila in a very, very broad sense. And all of these things really come together by understanding the teachings. The more acceptance you have of these teachings, the more confidence you have in them, the more faith you have in these things, the more powerful will be your ability to practice sila, to be mindful, to do all of these things. This is what it comes back to. This is why I'm so happy to be able to present some of these teachings. Yeah. Because hopefully it will then enhance in the future your ability, my ability, everyone's ability to practice these teachings. Okay.
Okay. Wie kann die Achtsamkeit von einem Moment zum nächsten Moment aufgebaut werden, indem man dem Vergessen der Achtsamkeit entgegenwirkt? Und das ist genau der Knackpunkt, dass man eben, um achtsam zu sein, muss man achtsam wahrnehmen, dass man gerade nicht achtsam ist. Und die Achtsamkeit wird dann eben leichter aufgebaut, wenn man den gegenwärtigen Moment und eben der Achtsamkeitspraxis und der Meditation den Vorrang einräumt und wenn man sich jedes Mal klar macht, dass das jetzt ganz besonders wichtig ist und wenn man das auch wirklich so empfindet. Wenn man die Wahrnehmung in diese Richtung verändern kann, dann wird die Achtsamkeit sich leichter einstellen. Mit diesem angenehmen Erleben des gegenwärtigen Momentes verbunden sein und sich dadurch leichter einstellen. Und langfristig gesehen ist das Wichtigste, um die Achtsamkeit zu entwickeln, eine ganz breite oder eine ganz die Entwicklung des Sila, der Ethik auf breiter Basis. Der Hintergrund für alles ist im Prinzip das Verständnis der das Verständnis der Lehre, des Wortes des Buddha, was der Buddha gesagt hat, das zu verstehen und darauf immer wieder zurückzukommen, das ist die Grundlage für all diese ganzen Qualitäten. Und das Schöne ist, dass ich das hier ein bisschen vermischen kann, dass es für euch gut ist, dass es auch für mich gut ist, dass es für alle gut ist, um nochmal einen Schritt weiterzukommen.
Okay. So, the next one. This is my first time listening to the Sutta teachings. I hear Ajahn Brahm regularly. Till now, I feel a bit lost. There are so many problems, dukkhas. How can I see the light to keep me going? Okay, so many of the things that we have done so far, I have been quite, I've been kind of diving into these suttas in the deep end in many ways. And in a couple of days' time, we're going to start the gradual training. And once we start the gradual training, it will be a very structured progress on how the Buddhist practice actually works. So we will start from the very beginning, from the point where somebody listens to the teachings and what happens, and then how the entire path evolves from that. And I think once we get to that, I think it will become much more clear to you what is happening here. But it's good, right? If you don't understand what is going on, there is potential for improvement. Yeah. That is always a positive thing. So see everything in a positive light. When you see it in a positive light, then it will kind of support you in your practice. It won't be so much dukkha, and you have a bit of sukha at the same time. But I'm pretty sure that in a few days' time, you will start to appreciate these teachings much more now. Okay.
Okay, das ist das erste Mal, dass ich bei einer Sutta-Erklärung zuhöre. Ich höre regelmäßig Ajahn Brahm. Aber bis jetzt fühle ich mich ein bisschen verloren. Es gibt so viele Probleme und Dukkhas. Und wie kann ich das Licht sehen, damit ich weitermachen kann? Wenn wir in ein paar Tagen mit dem stufenweisen Training anfangen, dann wird es eine sehr klare Struktur geben, wie man ausgehend vom Hören des Wortes des Buddha schrittweise den Pfad entwickeln kann. Das wird da sehr, sehr klar und strukturiert erklärt werden. Und das Gute ist, wenn im Moment ein bisschen Verwirrung da ist, dann kann sich daraus das bessere Verständnis dann entfalten. Und ich glaube, dass bei mir heute das Gedächtnis irgendwie nicht mitspielt. Tut mir leid. Aber ich hoffe, ich habe das Wichtigste gesagt.
What are you saying here?
I said my memory is not working tonight.
Oh, really? Okay, okay. Well, that's fine. Okay, good. Okay, so this is the last question for tonight. And this is about the law of karma. How does it work? How do you use karmic management to get something you want? For example, if you want a partner, meet someone regularly who is lonely to help them achieve the same goal? Is that how you actually get a partner in life? So by helping someone else to kind of find a partner, right? I wouldn't really recommend you to think about karma in that way. It is not the ideal way to think about karma. I'll explain a little bit about the way I like to think about karma, because it actually is a very important part of the Buddhist teachings. And the most important point is to use it in a way whereby it enhances your spiritual life. That is what really matters. If it enhances your spiritual life, you will become a more caring, compassionate, kind, happy person. And as a result of that, there is a greater chance you will find a partner, right? Because people will like you more. They will fall in love with you because you are such a wonderful person. And if it doesn't work, you will still be happy. Yeah? That is called win-win, win-win situation. That is the way to go about these things. So the way to think about karma is actually very simple. There in the suttas they talk about three types of karma. There is the karma that you do now and it ripens in this life. The karma that you do now and ripens in your next life. And there's a karma that you do now and ripens down the track, way down, so many, many lifetimes from now. So these are the three types of karma. Now the karma that is quite difficult to see is the karma that you do now and ripens in future lives, because it is difficult to make that connection, because it is a future event. But the karma that you do now that ripens in this very life is something that you can actually experience for yourself. And when you see that, you will actually, I think to a large extent, understand how the law of karma actually works. And it's very similar to what I was saying before. Yeah, we do acts based on delusion. We do activities. These activities are the sankharas. They are the volitional activities, the willed activities of the mind. And when we do that, when we do positive things with good intentions, with good motivations, how do you feel when you do an act of kindness? Yeah, suddenly, spontaneously, you do an act of kindness to somebody, an act of generosity, you say something nice, or sometimes even just thinking something nice. How do you feel about that? And usually, most people feel a sense of goodness. You feel happy about yourself. You feel, yeah, that was good. And you feel good about yourself because you do an act of kindness. If you do an act of which is not so nice, which is detrimental to somebody else, you say something a bit harsh, right, because you happen to be in a bad mood already or something like that, and afterwards you feel a bit of regret, perhaps. I shouldn't have said that. I spoke too quickly here. And you feel bad about what you're doing here. And if you can see that link between how you act in the present moment, your volitional activities here and now, the intention that you have, and the actions that come from those intentions, if you see the connection between those things and how you feel, that is basically understanding karma here and now in the present moment. You can see straight away how your consciousness is affected by the actions that you do. Yeah, this is the right way to think about this. And if you see that quite clearly, you start to get very, you get inspiration, you get motivated to do what is right, because you understand that your activities, your actions actually affect your state of mind straight away in the present life. And of course that will then also carry on into the future lives as well. And this is how karma in this life also has an effect in the future lives. But if you can see the link right here, right now in this life, and the more clearly you see that link, the more powerful becomes your motivation to do the right thing in this particular life. It's another very helpful way of enhancing your ability to practice well and to live a life of sila and live a life of morality here. And you start to understand, as you accumulate the good acts, you accumulate the good intentions, you're always lifting yourself up, because you're adding to the good feeling inside of yourself. You're adding to the change in consciousness that you're making all the time. If you do a bad act, the more you do of those, you're accumulating this weight in your mind that drags you down and makes you feel lack of energy, lack of mindfulness, and a lack of joy in life as a consequence. So that is how I would recommend this. And then let the partner come if they're ready. If not, there will be no partner here. See what happens.
Wie funktioniert das Karma-Gesetz? Gibt es eine Art Karma-Management, das man anwenden kann, um etwas zu erreichen, was man möchte? Zum Beispiel, wenn man einen Partner möchte, kann man dann anderen helfen, jemanden regelmäßig zu treffen, der einsam ist, damit der andere praktisch das gleiche Ziel erreicht und dass man damit sein eigenes Partnerkarma, wenn ich das richtig verstehe, erschafft. Und als er sagt, das ist nicht die Art, die er empfiehlt, das Karma zu betrachten. Es ist eher sinnvoll, dass man einfach den spirituellen Pfad praktiziert, so gut man kann, und selber zu einer besseren Person wird, und dann werden sich die anderen Menschen in einen verlieben und man findet viel leichter einen Partner, oder wenn nicht, ist man trotzdem froh. Die Art und Weise, wie er gerne über das Karma nachdenkt, ist die folgende. Der Buddha sagt, es gibt drei Arten von Karma. Karma, eine Handlung, die man in diesem Leben tut und die deren Frucht in diesem Leben auch reift. Das zweite ist eine Handlung, die man in diesem Leben tut und deren Frucht im nächsten Leben reift. Und das dritte ist eine Handlung, die man in diesem Leben tut und deren Frucht in einem noch späteren Leben reift. Und den Zusammenhang, die Verbindung zu sehen zwischen einer Handlung, die man in diesem Leben tut und deren Frucht in einem späteren Leben erst zur Reife kommt, die ist natürlich nicht so einfach zu sehen, aber eine Möglichkeit, wie man der Sache auf die Spur kommen kann, ist, dass man den eigenen Geist betrachtet. Wenn ich zum Beispiel jemandem etwas Nettes sage oder einen Gefallen tue, etwas Liebevolles tue, dann schaue ich mal, wie ich mich dann fühle und dann merke ich, dass ich, oder die meisten Leute würden sagen, dass sie sich dabei gut fühlen, dass sie das Gefühl haben, instinktiv, sie haben das Richtige gemacht, der Geist kommt in einen guten und angenehmen Zustand, während wenn man etwas Schlechtes tut, wenn man etwas weniger Freundliches oder Unpassendes sagt, weil man gerade vielleicht in einer schlechten Stimmung war, und dann fühlt man sich dementsprechend schlechter. Und anhand dieses Einflusses, den die Handlung unmittelbar auf den Geisteszustand jetzt in der Gegenwart hat, kann man absehen, ob das eine gute oder eine schlechte Handlung war. Und so wie der Geist sich eben jetzt in diesem Leben entfaltet, dieser Zustand, dieser geistige Zustand, der wird auch in ein späteres Leben mit hinübergenommen. Und das ist die Art und Weise, wo man sehen kann, wie die Handlungen in diesem Leben sich für die Zukunft weiterentwickeln werden und auswirken werden. Und das ist die Art und Weise, wie ich empfehle, über das Karma oder das Karma zu betrachten.
Okay, very good.
Okay.
Right. Okay. That's all for tonight then. So let's see you again tomorrow morning, and let's just pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha before we go.
Arahang Sammasambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Svakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sangang Namah.